stuff. Keep up the good work, Joe. And you could be a ARRL official observer, but you're not observing ham radio operators and the ones that fall out of their ham bands and giving them notices. You fall closer into the kind of enthusiasm of the Worldwide Television FMDX Association. And they used to print these beautiful manuals where you flip each page. Each page would be a particular television channel. You flip a particular page, channel 25. You'd see a map of the United States, including Mexico, the Caribbean, maybe Canada. And on there, you would see a dot with a call letter sign along each one of those dots. And on the spreadsheet portion of it, on the opposing page, each one of those call letters, they would tell you what is the station affiliation, ABC, NBC, CBS, independent, whatever. What is the city of license, the location, latitude, longitude, as I remember, or city of location, city of license, height above average terrain of antenna, transmitting power in kilowatts, beautiful pieces of information, and was there offset frequency plus 10 KC, minus KC, or zero? Let me drop. So as soon as you got an unusual channel appearing on your set by way of, and you knew it was channel 25, and you go to the page 25, so to speak, and now you know it's coming from a particular direction, and now in that compass direction you'd look at the, you think you're watching an ABC television program, and which of the television channels in that direction are ABC affiliated, and so on, and what's the offset frequency. You very seriously, very quickly in many cases, zero in on exactly what you're watching, so that when you file your report that gets published in the next monthly magazine, people will know whether or not you were hearing something from 200 miles away or 2,000 miles away. And at times that was very exciting as a method of studying propagation, because what better way to study propagation than to use these, in some cases, 50,000 watt beacons that are called television channels. In the case of UHF television, some of the UHF television channels are transmitting 5 million watts of effective isotropic radiated power, peak envelope power during the sync pulse. 5 million watts. So because that signal is, let me pick a number, 30 or 40 dB stronger than anything else you can imagine, because it's that much stronger, and if a band opening is about to start happening on the nearest ham radio frequency, you're getting 30 or 40 dB of a forewarning. As the signal starts getting stronger and stronger, you know when to start tuning a little bit lower in frequency to hear the ham radio frequencies. And you know you're getting a band opening to that particular portion of the country, because these very high power beacons are very well known in location, very well known in effective radiated power, very well known in frequency and modulation techniques and station affiliation. So as a way of studying propagation, broadcast stations, television broadcast stations are a beautiful way to do it. So you've probably never seen one of those manuals. Someday I'll have to show you one. And I don't know if the Worldwide Television FMDX Association still publishes those things, but they're beautiful manuals. The last one I got, as I remember, was vintage 1985 or something like that. So all of the television channels that existed at that time were on those flip charts. This was a spiral ring 8.5 by 11 thing. And as you flipped open each page, the upper page would be the map of the United States with all the call letters and locations, and the bottom half of the page would be the spreadsheet of all the data on each one of those stations. Nowadays, by way of the right website, I'm sure there's even faster access to all that information. Out of curiosity, Joe, how many websites have you discovered that will tell you all of that information as to what frequency, what channel, what location, what affiliation, and whatever? W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W on the TechNet. Eric recognized. Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
Oh, I haven't counted all the websites. There's a handful I have as marked as favorites on my desktop, but there's one main one I use. I can't remember the exact format of it. I have a computer on to look at it. Just save it as a desktop. But that one is really good for digital TV. Main broadcasting digital TV stations throughout the whole country. But it does not list a lot of low-power stations. I found some low-power stuff that's not on that particular website. Over to Eric.
Okay, Eric. Hope you've heard some of this early station or early question, and maybe you can fill us in. KE2EJ, our local broadcast engineer, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. The best way and the easiest way to find out is by going to the FCC website. cnn.gov/MB. MB meaning video, media bureau, and then do a video query, and you can do it by location, by call sign, by latitude and longitude. That will tell you exactly who it is, where it is, how much power, ERP, who the owner is, etc.
Okay, you probably know there's quite a bit of hum on your signal because I think you're running off of a power supply. FCC.gov/MB, standing for Media Bureau, and after that, with the right additional selections, we'll find out all of the broadcast information we want for both digital and analog. Out of curiosity, if you happen to know, Eric, the low-power analog television stations that still persist, is it likely that some of them will be there forever, or are they only going to be there for a certain length of time and their license will run out and they'll have to go over to digital? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Net tonight at 8 o'clock. Welcome to the...
Sorry about my hop. It's a stinky little power supply. They have to be digital by 2013 or they're gone, and they have to be below channel 51. And every low-power station, every full-power station, every Class A station is listed on that website.
Okay, they've got to be below channel 21, and they're all going to be gone by some portion of 2013. The beginning of that year, the middle of the year, the end of the year? What's your guess on that one, Eric?
I don't remember precisely. I think it's June. It's below channel 51. They're not licensing anything above 51. It imagines it can go to 54, but it seems like Congress wants to take more.
Okay, they got to be below 51. Are the low-power television stations also below 51, or did I hear you earlier say below 21? Where is low-power TV allowed to be, Eric? Go ahead.
Below 51. That includes standard broadcast stations, so Class A stations, full-power stations. And when you get to fcc.gov/MB, you go to Video Queries.
Okay, fcc.gov/MikeBravo/video blank. What was that other word, video something?
Video query. Query to search.
Okay, video query. Because of the hum, I wasn't able to pick out that word. Slightly unusual word, video query. I may even have trouble spelling it. Good information, Eric. Anything else you think we should know about low-power TV stations? As you know, the mystery is that when Joe aims his high-gain, low-noise figure antenna at various places to the west, southwest, northwest, he sees stations on near Channel 3, analog television, low-power, 61.24, 61.25, 61.26, plus or minus 10 kilohertz of offset. They make some sense. But he's seeing this really... He's positive it's a real television channel. It's got the right kind of modulation on 61.197. 61.197. And to be that crazy in frequency for a video carrier, and in his case, it's coming from 235 degrees bearing. Got any guesses as to what that Spanish-like station could be? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
61, is that channel 3?
Yeah, channel 3 is from 60 to 66 megs. 1.25 megs in should be the video carrier, 61.25. He's seeing 61.197 megahertz, 61.197. A really crazy number for a Spanish-speaking video carrier. Any guesses? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, let me point out a couple things. Most low-power stations don't use GPS, so... They're not exactly on frequency. The frequency requirements are still the same as they were with full power stations, but a lot of these cheap transmitters just don't cut it, even though they're FCC type approved. And if you give me a minute, I'll tell you what's around. I'm not aware of Channel 3. By the way, Dick Bogner's station on Channel 6 and all that stuff, their company went belly up, and it looks like the Philippine Broadcasting Group is taking taking that over.
So Bogner, and I think you said on channel 6, is gone. Okay, so once again, 61.197, and if that was just a frequency error problem, they are 53 kilohertz too low of a normal frequency. That's a lot of error. I think a normal broadcast has to be accurate to approximately 1 kilohertz. Is that true?
It's supposed to be 10 cycles. I don't know how he's measuring the frequencies, though. You know, video being that kind of modulation, it's very hard to put your finger on the exact carrier frequency when you're looking at it on a spectrum analyzer, black on black, on and so forth.
I was measuring it on a service monitor hooked up to the same antenna port as was a color, small portable color television. So what I was seeing, I was able to look at visually with my service monitor. I was not making an error in the frequency measurement.
A rough guess, Joe. When you are reading a carrier frequency, a video carrier frequency by your method, give me a rough guess. Do you think you can get to the nearest 1 kilohertz as to what the center frequency of the video carrier is? What's your rough guess as to your accuracy, assuming that your service monitor itself has no additional error? Over to you, Joe.
I measured it in the AM mode of the service monitor, and prior to measuring it, I verified my service monitor was reading the digital RF carriers on the .3094 frequencies above the bottom end of the carrier, and everything I was measuring was within 50 hertz, plus or minus of that frequency. So I think I was pretty close to being good.
No, I wouldn't doubt your service monitor. It's a matter of deciding where the zero frequency is with sync rolling around on it.
Okay, so assuming that his method of measurement has no significant error to it, maybe a kilohertz or two, and they appear to be, 53 kilohertz low of the center frequency of, you know, no offset, that seems like an awful lot of error. When the spec is 10 hertz, wow. But some of the inexpensive transmitters, low-power TV, nobody's really checking is what I think is going on here. On top of that, the typical television viewer with his ordinary set, that number of kilohertz of offset, the television itself would never know the difference. So nobody's going to complain is what I think is going on. KE2EJ for any other comments? K2RIW on the TechNet?
You know, the one thing I will say is that the frequency monitors I used to use on the analog actually had a demodulator and a couple of circuits to kind of figure out where the actual frequency is, but during the off times or into the dummy load, the way you would actually measure the frequency accurately is have no modulation on the signal, and, you know, with television, that never happens.
During the time that the television signal goes to black, and you have nothing really there but the sync pulses, I think life becomes a little bit easier to figure out where the zero beat of the carrier is. Yeah, you still got the horizontal sync pulses and the vertical sync pulses, but they have a very characteristic sine X over X kind of a waveform to them. So I'm going to give Joe the benefit of the doubt on this one, that he's getting the real frequency. And so, you guys have something you want to add to that one, Eric?
Hey, don't let yourself get fooled by sync. That's maximum, you know? That's not minimum. That's where the maximum energy is. But depending upon how you set the bandwidth of your spectrum analyzer, and bandwidth resolution on most service monitors, you don't get too much control over that. That's where you want to be able to filter the 15 kilohertz out in order to find out where the actual peak is. So, you know, I've seen people incorrectly read the frequency, thinking that they're on the peak. So, you know, I'll leave it at that.
BH4YY.
KC2FYJ.
Joe first, and FYJ after that. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, the service model I'm using is an IFR 1500. It has an independent spectrum analyzer, independent of the receiver operation. So I can receive something on a frequency up to a span width of 1 megahertz per box. Well, on the analyzer, if that the receiver locks out, it won't receive. But what I was able to look at and what I was able to hear was actually independent. And the receiver I was decoding it first in AM, and then it went to SSB, and actually went 1 kHz below that to actually verify. I was looking at something pretty much on the frequency I had listed at 61.197. It's maybe 100 Hz higher than that or something like that. But I'm pretty certain I was measuring it accurately. But my question is, I guess, since you're here, south of the border, what do they use down in Mexico? Do they use the same band of television frequencies for broadcasting, or are they broadcasting completely someplace different? And that would also include parts of, say, Central America, that region. Because I have no idea what I was actually viewing.
You've got it, Eric.
Sorry, I was just looking through the FCC website. I missed that.
Okay, he's asking you, are the frequency allocations for analog television in places like Central America and Mexico and the Caribbean, are they fairly similar to our channels here in the United States, or are their frequencies offset in certain ways that he's maybe seeing a clue of? Over to you, Eric.
Any country that has NTSC or ATSC, the channel frequencies will be similar. The other countries that do PAL-M, PAL, which is mostly the rest of the world, though, the frequency and the channel allocations are different.
Understand. Now, Harry, FYJ, I wonder if you work in broadcast and you've got some hints on this. Harry to take it, one of our directors, KC2FYJ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Harry, are you there?
Yes, Dick. Sorry, I just stepped away from the mic for a moment. I just wanted to say I was poking around on the FCC website looking for the site that Eric had told us about, and it's slightly different than what you were saying, possibly partly because they're redoing the FCC website. But if I found what I think he was suggesting, it's transition.fcc.gov/mb/video/tvq.html.
You go to the video division and then do a TV query. And there's a channel 3 in Brooklyn, by the way.
Any idea what offset frequency it's on, Eric?
It would be the standard channel 3 frequency, which I think is 6125. Yeah, it's a low power. Again, a lot of low power. The FCC doesn't bother to look at stuff, although I worked on a low power that was on channel 20 that was causing a little interference, and then the FCC took notice and fined them.
I think you're saying they wait until somebody complains. From his location on South Shore, where Joe is, he's getting the signal at a bearing of 235 degrees because of the way Long Island tilts. I guess if the station was located on the South Shore of Brooklyn, it could possibly fall into that bearing, or somewhere in central or southern New Jersey would also fall into that bearing. From my location, let's see now, 235 degrees, 240 degrees would fall on Perth Amboy, New Jersey. I know I used to talk to a guy there on 10 gigs. That's where I used to have to set the antenna to peek up on him with a 2-degree beam with him. Okay, fascinating stuff. I wonder if we've got a Paul WS2N on frequency, because NASA's about to do something pretty interesting. Paul WS2N, are you on tonight, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Dick, yeah, this is WS2N. Yes, I am here. And let's see, what are they going to do? I'm not up on what, let's see, I didn't see much this week. What did you see, Dick?
One quickie, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, Harry.
Yeah, earlier you were talking about the unified S-band system for the lunar program. I was poking around on the web, and I found the proceedings of the Apollo Unified S-Band Technical Conference. The document is available online, and it's supposed to be the most comprehensive record of the USB system. And if you want, I can give you the URL.
The URL is probably pretty long. I guess the main thing you can tell us is what search word did you use with Google to find that unified S-band report? Over to you, Harry.
S-band NASA. And it was the second item on the list that I got back, the unified S-band system.
Okay, so you used as a search word S-band NASA, and the second item was unified S-band with this beautiful report that probably goes on for 50 pages, because I know that when I visited the NASA headquarters, at Houston, Texas, right after Apollo 13 failure, I was there about a month or two later, or maybe it was two, a little bit longer than that, but I heard a lot of inside stories as to what really took place, and that was a much more serious situation than the average person knows about. It really was close to life and death. I managed to get handed to me by one of their engineers this very nice two-inch thick manual, green manual, that explains all the intricacies of the unified S-band system. If that's on a website, that's a lot of data. So
that is, in fact, the document. It's NASA SP-87, known as the Green Book. And the URL isn't terribly long. If you want, I can give it to you.
Okay, go ahead, give it to us.
www.hq.nasa.gov/ALSJ/ALSJ-NASA-SP-87.html. And the document is Neil Sanford's copy that's been digitized. He's ex-Honeysuckle, and he worked with Bill Wood, ex-Goldstone, to document it. It's got a stamp, a serialized number of 30 on it. It's 27 megabytes, 316 pages.
I got to find out what serial number I was given of the Green Book in roughly 1971. In other words, you're telling me I've got a piece of history there. You may or may not know that on Apollo 13, the guys at Honeysuckle Creek in Australia, using their 210-foot dish, decided that if anything ever went wrong with the system, they wanted to be able to separate the frequencies between the command module and the lunar module. And as you know, during the Apollo 13 failure, essentially all power was lost for many hours on the command module, and the lunar module was the only way that they could communicate. And as such, the equipment on the lunar module was never designed to operate in that manner. And the engineers in Honeysuckle Creek worked on a whole lot of techniques for taking the frequency of this closed-loop system. Let me drop. And very carefully walking it off in frequency so that the frequencies coming out of the lunar module and the frequencies coming out of the command module would not interfere with each other. And so what the engineers in Honeysuckle Creek did, believe it or not, as unsung heroes, the world doesn't know about this, they had an awful lot to do with the communication being continued and the survival of those astronauts. Because when you're a quarter of a million miles away, the only connection you have with humanity for all of the human beings on the Earth is that one radio beam. If it fails, and you use the biggest telescope we got on Earth, Mount Palomar, yeah, you'll see a dot in space, maybe, if you know just where to look. You won't be able to tell, are they upside down, right side up? You won't be able to tell, you know, are they flashing a sign in the window at you, or whatever. Without that radio beam, you really have no way of knowing what in the world is going on. I wonder if you've ever heard about that story, Harry. KC2FYJ, K2RIW, MTechNet.
Actually, no, I had not heard that. I don't know too much of the details of what went on during that problem era. And I just remember listening to it as a kid. So I was not actively following it at a technical level, though.
And you could say neither was I at first, because the first thing that I listened to was Apollo 15 and Apollo 16. Apollo 13 occurred, about a year or so earlier. And so I hadn't established any of that system, hadn't done any listening yet, hadn't even gotten the curiosity. I was working on the development of a spectrum analyzer at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and suddenly one day in early 1971, I said, gee, this thing operates very nicely at those frequencies. It's got a phase lock loop system that can lock to the nearest 10 hertz to whatever frequency you want to dial. It can lock to the nearest frequency, to the nearest of anything you want to listen to, and I could do all kinds of great things. So I suddenly realized that I could use it as a down converter into my ham radio equipment to listen to astronaut audio. And that's how it all got started. Okay. Paul, the main thing I was going to tell you is that I found a website that suddenly popped up because of something I was looking at with reference to Curiosity. Curiosity is the name of the great big spacecraft, the Mars, what's it called now? Mars Science Laboratory, I think it is, that's going to be sent to Mars in December of 2011. In other words, a couple of months from now, roughly December, this thing is going to be sent. This thing is about the size of a small Volkswagen, if I understand correctly. When you go to that website and you see their particular movie, let me drop. They've got a beautiful animation movie that shows you the landing sequence, the encounter, injection, and the landing sequence of the Curiosity Mars Science Laboratory. When you see the way that thing, the sequence that goes through in order to set that spacecraft down on the surface of Mars, you'll say, wow. Boy, I hope all that hardware works. My goodness, is that an unusual system. So, and then when you start going to the various portions of that website, I think, again, it's one of these things where you just Google the word Curiosity, NASA Curiosity spacecraft, Mars Science Laboratory, beautiful piece of electronics, a lot more elaborate than Spirit and Opportunity or the Sojourner and the earlier two spacecraft that were crawling around on Mars. And this thing is going to be a lot faster, bigger, better, more scientific stuff. It can aim a laser at a rock, burn a hole in the rock, look at the optical reflection and figure out what kind of materials are there without even touching the rock. Or then go over there and drill a hole in it and collect the dust and put it inside the laboratory. So it's a real good website. That's kind of exciting stuff. I sure hope all of that works. And that saga is going to begin in roughly December of 2011. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Paul.
Okay, very good, Dick. And yeah, that's one of the better animations I've seen. And it went on and on. And it not only through the landing, but after the landing, it had it riding around, and they did show the laser and all. So, yeah, very good. Yeah, that thing has to come down. Yeah, it's got a sky crane, so you got the aero shells that have to separate. This is after the cruise stage. So then now this thing is exposed. It's got the sky crane. It's got, I think, 8 rocket engines that will come on. This is after all the parachute opens up and everything after the parachute. You got these rocket engines that will fire and then lower the Curiosity down on a cable and drop it. And then as it nears the surface, it's going to, as it actually touches the surface, after, I think, like a half a second, the cables will be cut, and the sky crane will fly away from the whole craft and go quite a distance, and then it will then be sitting on a planet. Totally different than the airbag system that they use for Spirit and Curiosity, and of course for Pathfinder. Those things bounced along the planet. It had its own platform that it was sitting on. The wheels had to unfold and then drive down a ramp. That's the way Spirit and Opportunity did it. This thing here is going to be coming down, and actually wheels will be touching the ground and then will drive away. And the reason for that is this thing is so much heavier. This is like the size of a car, small car. Spirit and Opportunity, the size of a golf cart. The weight is about 5 times greater as well. So, you know, if that was heavy weight, they couldn't go with the airbag system. They had to do something different for these additional weight. It's really launched by similar rockets, the Delta II, and they had to do something really special. So I hope it all works. Dick, let me drop it. Pushed it back. Yeah, I think it was originally supposed to go around now, and then they pushed it back to November, and now I guess December. And 7 or 8 months out, this thing will be going through this whole process. So, you know, the only thing I wish they did was two missions. NASA always had its greatest success when it always had two missions. In case one went down, the other one would succeed. You know, that went back to the early days in the 60s when they used to put up the Mariner missions to Venus and to Mars. They would launch like Mariner 1 and Mariner 2, Mariner 3 and 4. You know, 2 and 4 were successful. 1 and 3 went into the drink. So the Russians would launch 1, and if it would fail, they didn't have a backup. We launched 2 Voyagers. We launched 2 Vikings to Mars, 2 Pioneers to the outer solar system. So you know, a lot of times you'd have both craft working, so you get, you know, 2 for 1. Same with Spirit and Opportunity. They didn't do it with Pathfinder and the Sojourner that rode around on the planet. But they did do it with Spirit and Opportunity. Look how that worked out. Years and years, six years later, well, one of the craft, Spirit, is not working anymore, but Opportunity is still going. Back to you, Dick, for now, WS2N.
Yeah, poor old Spirit with its failed wheel, stuck in the mud, so to speak, in a sand pile and can't get out. And its solar panels are not tilted the right way. It's not getting enough sunlight to keep its battery charged, so I think it's essentially dead. Whereas so Spirit lost some of its spirit, but Opportunity is still going. And hopefully they'll get the same kind of mileage out of Curiosity, the Mars Science Laboratory. And like you said, when you look at that space crane and you look at that sequence for landing, encounter and entry and landing, wow. Elaborate looking. I look at all of those things that all have to fire to the nearest fraction of a second just right. And I'm sure it's a fairly expensive craft. I hope it goes well. We got a lot of money riding on a lot of eggs in one particular basket there, but if it works, that's going to be fun. And I'm convinced, as you guys have heard me say many times, although I really like astronauts in space doing things, when it comes to a Mars mission, I'm convinced that is not the right place for a human being during the next century or so, maybe even two centuries. It's not the right place. It's the coldest, driest, worst desert with ridiculous amounts of solar radiation, X-rays and everything else, cosmic rays, no real atmosphere. You don't want to put a human being there. And the chances of getting him back, getting him there alive are very slim. Getting him back alive are almost impossible. And the total cost would be prohibitive unless every single nation on this planet contributed financially to the project. And what would they get in return? They would get a man on Mars for a certain number of months, or a couple of men on Mars for a certain couple of months. And the real data you want, Curiosity, this Mars Science Laboratory, is going to very objectively give you a tremendous amount of data for years at a time. It's exciting to see a man standing on Mars. For our students to dream about that and to work in that direction and to develop the technology, great. But because of the difficulty of supplying all of the consumables that a human being needs. Now just to give you 2 more sentences on this, let me drop this. We all conveniently forget that the oxygen you breathe, the water you drink, the food that you eat, has the volume of your house in 1 year. It has the mass of your house in 1 year. That's what you consume. And this planet you live on recycles every single one of those molecules, and they all come back to some other human being at some other time. Every breath that you take contains air molecules that were once inside the lungs of every human being that has ever walked this planet. Every single molecule is recycled. To do that in space without an Earth backing you up, I won't say it's impossible, but it's darn close to it. How in the world are you going to give the human being 3 years worth of consumables when it's a house worth per year per human being? And can you recycle every one of those things with the machinery on board flawlessly with no failures for 3 years? I don't think so. We all conveniently forget that. Go ahead, John.
Dick, I think you're 100% right, because you're going to see with the dexterity that has been given to surgeons who are on the other side of the earth performing operations, it seems a moot point to send a human there. We're getting to the point where probably in 30 years when we're ready to attempt it, it's going to be a robotic mission. I believe that 100%.
Yeah, the nice thing about a robot, if it fails, you don't kill somebody. If it works well, it can drive around on Mars for years. You can't put a human being on Mars for years. I just don't see it happening. And there are people who are so enthusiastic that even if it was a one-way mission and they have no hope of coming back, there are people who would volunteer. But our ethics won't really allow that. Would NASA allow a human being to go on a sacrificial mission, knowing he's going to go there, make some measurements, write home electronically, so to speak, and then die?
He said it would like it a dog, Dick.
Yeah, well, to do it, the experiments that we do on animals, mice and monkeys and rabbits and whatever, even that's a little bit, the protection for animals organizations are not happy with that. But at least we can almost justify experimenting on an animal. But to experiment on a human being, to send him on a one-way mission, knowing he's going to die, and you fund that, it's a kind of a suicide mission. Do you really let a person announce ahead of time that he wants to die in this manner? I just don't think that the ethics of NASA and Congress would support that. You got a guess on that one, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW, the tech man.
Russians weren't even happy about liking a dog. They did it with two dogs. They did send two dogs up afterwards and brought them back. But not even them, they were happy about that. And that's exactly what they did. No, nobody would fund that. That's absolutely out of the question. Are there volunteers that would do it? Yeah, probably. But it's not going to be funded. It's not a success until you bring them back. Let me drop it.
What about detainees from Guantanamo Bay? KC2, QIQ.
I don't think so. But you've got a situation where you're going to send probably maybe 3-4 people will land on that planet and come back. So, you know, you're looking at maybe 100 years from now to do that successfully. Even if you send this new spacecraft up, it's going to be, the rocket is bigger than the Saturn V. You'd have to probably send 2 or 3 of them, link them all together with enough material to get you there and back. I mean, they might do it for an asteroid, but even that, you know, you got to go all the way past Mars to the asteroid belt and then try to bring them back. You're going to have plenty of consumables there. You probably need at least 2 years for that alone. So, I don't know. I got to see a lot more plans. I know suicide missions aren't going to work there.
Yeah, there's been a couple of news reports where they've interviewed an astronaut who said, I would go in a heartbeat. The project sounds so exciting. I would go on a one-way mission. Wild. There's another problem now. John just said, why don't we send a volunteer, I put the word volunteer in quotes, from Guantanamo Bay, and that wouldn't work. One of the things you don't know about is what goes on behind the scenes. You take, for instance, a space shuttle repair mission to the Hubble Space Telescope, and you're actually going to be at the telescope for, let me pick a number, 4 or 5 days, something like that. That mission goes through training exercise for all the human beings on board for 2 solid years, day in and day out, for 2 years. You plan every single move the hand makes. during every one of the minutes that you're on station to make sure that you have the right tool in the right position at the right time doing the right function so that you can squeeze it all in the small amount of time you've got with your consumables when you're on station with the Hubble Space Telescope. Tremendous amount of training takes place of a very skilled, carefully chosen human being. You're just going to take somebody as a volunteer out of a prison, and you think there's not going to be a language barrier. He's going to have all that technical training because of his past history, and then you're going to give him 2 years of training. Let me drop.
That wasn't me that recommended that. That was Glenn. I suggested we send Wesley.
Don't do that. Hey, Glenn, give us some words on this if that was you, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, the TechNet, and... Glenn, we were talking about you earlier with reference to his inductors and capacitors and charging. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. That was just light humor. Back to you, KC2QIQ.
Now, you're allowed to say you agree, disagree, and whatever with reference to the discussion on charging capacitors at 98% efficiency. Over to you, Glenn.
Oh yeah, I think we went over that. Yeah, it's certainly when the capacitors and inductors are in resonance, they're sharing voltage and current in a relatively low loss manner. You know, excluding any ESR resistances that are in the circuit, but just the L and the C in resonance are sharing the energy perfectly at that point, losslessly. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Now, when you get a chance, John, I sent you an email with reference to Wimshurst machines. I know that over the last few weeks you've expressed some interest in those, and you seem to have the opinion that they could be pretty expensive. And there are a few companies that make reasonable quality Wimshurst machines for nowadays numbers like $79 and $90. When I bought mine 3 years ago, and I was so happy with it, a week or two later I bought a second one, and it was being sold for $59 then. And mine is still operating, as long as it's properly maintained. For those who don't know what a Wimshurst machine is, you maybe have seen them in science laboratories from time to time. It's a real fun project. Mr. Wimshurst invented the thing roughly back in 1860 or so. In those days, that was the best way of studying electronics and high-voltage circuits. The machine consists of what looks like two 10-inch diameter phonograph records, usually made out of clear plastic these days, but not always. A whole bunch of metal strips are on each one of the phonograph records. The two phonograph records are eighths of an inch apart from each other, and they rotate in opposite directions. You turn the crank, and there are two separate rubber belts that turns one of the phonograph records clockwise, and the other one is counterclockwise. And with the right kind of shorting bars and pick-up metal brushes, that machine, by an static electricity-like phenomena, it's really a electrostatic repulsion impulse machine, that thing can easily generate at least 75 kilovolts, and when I carefully tune the one that I've got, and when I've gone through the learning curve of what the thing will do, it will generate something like 200 kilovolts. I can jump a spark every 3 or 4 seconds. The spark can jump 3 5/8 inches, 3 inches and 5/8 inches more. And every one of those sparks is a zigzag, and it's a real exciting thing to see. The thing is relatively safe. The total stored energy there is a small enough fraction of a joule that if you discharge that thing from your left hand to your right hand, it would be extremely unpleasant. It would give you a jump of your muscle structure, but it's not enough joules to put your heart into fibrillation. It's below the threshold of danger, and I'm thinking of building a slightly higher power version, and you got to be damn careful with it. But when it comes to these high-voltage machines, a Wimshurst machine makes DC. In other words, one probe turns out the high-voltage positive and the other one high-voltage negative. And the voltage between the two can be close to 100 kilovolts even before you start tuning them carefully. And what's nice about that machine compared to a Van de Graaff generator is that, I said Van de Graaff generator, I really mean
Tesla coil.
I mean Tesla coil, exactly. A Tesla coil makes AC, and AC is nice high voltage, it'll jump a gap. But when you've got a DC machine, you'll soon discover that the positive terminal of, say, a Leyden jar and the negative terminal of a Leyden jar, you've got two Leyden jars side by side. One of them gets positive voltage, one of them gets negative voltage. The positive voltage behaves very differently than the negative voltage. The negative voltage has got a whole lot of excess electrons, and those electrons are extremely mobile. They do things very different than the positive charge. The positive charge one has got the same amount of charge on each particle, but those charges are 1,000 times less mobile. And so you get some very interesting experiments looking at the difference of high voltage positive versus high voltage negative. And you can make machines that will ring bells and turn wheels and do all kinds of things. You can make an electrostatic motor as opposed to a magnetic motor. And I've done one of those things. So there's some fancy experiments you can do. And now, one of the websites that Wes and John have discovered shows a red Wimhurst machine being used in a way to charge a capacitor. And by charging the capacitor first without these extra spark gaps and then with the extra spark gaps, it appears as though the extra spark gaps are charging a greater amount of energy into the capacitor, the external circuit that they added to it to charge a capacitor. And you could come to the conclusion that the spark gaps themselves do some kind of magic that increases the amount of energy, that you've got a machine by way of the spark gaps that has more than a positive, more than 100% transfer. That's one possible interpretation. When I look at that website and carefully look at those oscilloscope waveforms, there's a hidden piece of information there that we've been missing. Let me drop. When you look at those oscilloscope waveforms on that website, and the website, by the way, I think a person can find it. It's probably got a pretty long URL, but I believe you can find it by just using the right search word. And one of the search words you'd want to use, let me see if I can find it again here. Where in the world did I put it? I wanted to make sure that I had it for demonstration here tonight. Ah, there it is. Wimhurst machine, YouTube. If I got the right one. Nope, got the wrong one.
Dick?
Yeah, what is the search word that allows us to find that? Go ahead.
I'm not sure if this is the one you're looking for, but I just did a search on Wimhurst machine plans, and the second entry was Bruce's Wimhurst machine from the steampunk workshop, and it's plans for building your very own.
Yeah, but since you can buy one for $79, and when you look at the amount of material there and the amount of work you'd have to do a man-week worth of work to build that, and you can buy it with a few hours of your salary, if you know what I mean. So I would much rather see a person, if he wants to be economic, I'd much rather see a person, what's the word I'm looking for here, buy it first and build it later if you want to make a modified version, as opposed to completely building it homebrew all the way. That's an opinion. I wonder if you got that website that I sent John, because I think you're the guy that had the greatest amount of interest right now, and I wonder if any of that looked exciting to you. While I'm looking, here I found it. It's called the Multi-Spark Gap Experiment. All right. This particular website, beautiful website, nice picture. Multi-Spark Gap Experiments is the title. Dated February 23rd, 2006. And it's not a real long URL, but I bet you if a person did a multi-spark gap experiment as they search words on a Google search, I think you would find this thing. And when you find the right one, it's got about six pictures. The very first picture shows this beautiful laboratory with a Wimhurst machine that's got nice red wheels to it, nice red discs. Over to you first, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, I've been looking at that website, Dick, and I do like that machine. That's a very very pretty machine. It seems to work well, too. And I did get your email, and I read through it. I saw that you had purchased yours, I believe, from Amazon.com. The only thing that scares me about that Wimhurst machine, I have so much equipment that is sensitive. I don't know where I could operate it in my lab without destroying something. That would be my biggest concern. But I'm definitely going to get a machine. I just have to figure out where. I'll probably use it on my kitchen table. Probably be the safest place.
Now, it's possible that I was ultra-conservative when I gave you that warning. It was a guy who worked on a bunch of high-voltage circuits who told me to be careful. And there was a failure of my digital voltmeter that was operating 3 feet away from the Wimhurst machine. And when I finally troubleshooted my digital voltmeter, and found out what was wrong. By way of the burned contacts inside, it became overly obvious to me that the person who borrowed it from me had it in the ampere scale. In other words, he plugged in the leads to the other plug-in points that allows you to measure external current as opposed to voltage. And he apparently put it across a charge capacitor or whatever, because I found charged contacts on the rotary switch inside. No way in hell can a Wimshurst machine do that. A Wimshurst machine turns out to, you know, 10 or 20 microamperes, and it had burned contacts inside that I had to repair. And then my digital voltmeter came back to life. I did have an experience, 10 years ago, where I bought a Edmund Scientific Wimshurst machine. I knew it generated high voltage. I had a very inexpensive digital voltmeter. I made the mistake of connecting the digital voltmeter from the positive lead to the negative lead. The digital voltmeter was good up to something like 500 volts. My intention was to just start turning the wheel very slowly until the digital voltmeter registered something. That was the intent. The digital voltmeter never moved. And so I said, well, maybe the thing is not charging. And I turned it a little bit more and turned it a little bit more. To make a long story short, I burned out every single integrated circuit inside that very inexpensive digital voltmeter, and it never ran again. And I went and bought those chips and replaced them, and it still didn't want to run. It was a very unhappy machine. So do not connect your digital voltmeter directly across it. So the failure that I thought I had more recently turned out...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Question about this thing, Nick, WS2M.
Yeah, Paul recognized. The failure that I thought I had recently turned out to be a false alarm. And these ions that I said it issues, I'm now of the opinion that those ions don't travel more than a foot or two away. So almost all the instrumentation you've got in your laboratory are shielded kinds of signal generators and oscilloscopes and spectrum analyzers and network analyzers and whatever. Other than a nearby nuclear blast, you're not going to hurt them. Or nearby electromagnetic pulse, but you're not going to do that. So I think I'm overly conservative, so stop worrying. It's not that dangerous. I've been operating this thing for 3 years. I operate it in my living room alongside of the television set, the digital video cassette recorder, and whatever. The one thing that used to drive my television set crazy was the Van de Graaff generator. That's the thing that looks like a great big ball on top of a plastic rod. And that thing will generate 150 kilovolts. And ever when I operate it, it doesn't have a clearly defined ground. It uses the 110-volt line plugged into its motor as the ground. I notice that my television set goes haywire every time. The remote control function of the television set goes haywire whenever I run that Van de Graaff generator. Somehow the high voltage spikes through the ground that's connected to the same plug socket in the wall to the television set. The television set goes into a haywire mode where the remote control no longer works. All I've got to do is unplug the television set, let its power supply go to zero, plug it back in, it reboots its program, and after that it comes back to operation. So that's the only piece of instrumentation I have really seen go haywire, and it was a Van de Graaff generator that did it. The Wimshurst machine never did it. I'll be turning it back to you for further comments or questions on this one, John. But first we'll go over to Paul. Have you ever seen one of these Wimshurst machines in operation, Paul? They're kind of fun. WS2N, K2RIW.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You've got it, Paul.
Maybe on some old sci-fi show, you know. I don't know. You might see something like the Van de Graaff generator along with the Jacob's ladder going in and maybe one of these spinning things. But I'm just curious about the... these two plates, they're spinning opposite one another. What the reason is for that, is it just so you could use you get a certain amount of RPMs out of your motor and you're going to double it by having them spin opposite one another? Or can you just, nowadays you could really have good, fast motors. You could probably leave one plate not spin and just have the other one spin, or the centrifugal force play a part in this. Is that why both have to be spinning? Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, when you see the website we're talking about called Multi-Spark Gap Experiments, they've got a beautiful diagram that gives you some of the theory of operation. the two plates that'll, they look like two 10-inch diameter phonograph records in some versions. Some versions they make them out of clear materials. And these two plates are mounted on a common shaft, and the two plates are about an eighth of an inch apart from each other. The two plates do not touch each other. Each plate has a whole bunch of metal plates mounted on it that look like spokes. It's got a whole bunch of metal spokes that are connected to nothing. These are free individual spokes, and there's about 12 of them. And you've got a bunch of brushes that pick up the charge that's picked up by those middle plates. And one of those sets of brushes goes to the positive Leyden jar, one of them goes to the negative, and there's a bunch of other metallic brushes in the thing. And you're asking, how does it work? Let me drop. The theory of operation is a little bit complicated, but every object that has a well-insulated Leyden jar, well-insulated, clean plastic disc with these metallic spokes, and the metallic spokes connect to nothing. That kind of a machine is always going to have, because something Mother Nature did, a cosmic ray or whatever, there's going to be a little bit of imbalance. One of those Leyden jars is going to have plus 1 volt compared to the other, for instance. And when those two metal plates, one turns clockwise, one of those two plastic plates, the 10-inch diameter discs, when one of them turns clockwise and one of them turns counterclockwise, by way of a hand crank, you've got a hand crank with two separate rubber belts. One rubber belt goes around the forward, the 10-inch diameter plastic disc that's closest to you. The other rubber belt goes to the one that's furthest away from you. And one of the rubber belts has got a figure eight. It's got a twist in it so that the same turn of the crank turns one disc clockwise and one disc counterclockwise. When the discs turn in a counterclockwise direction, the way the charge is induced onto those metal spokes and the way the grounding bars transfer charge from one side to the other, you get kind of a bootstrapping effect, so that the net result is that if the right-hand Leyden jar had plus 1 volt and the left-hand Leyden jar had 0 volts by comparison, and you turn the crank, it does a kind of voltage multiplication. After one turn, the right-hand Leyden jar has got 10 volts, and the left one's got minus 10 volts. And after a few more turns, the right-hand jar has got plus 1,000 volts, and the left-hand one's got 10,000 volts, 1,000 volts negative, and so on. And it very rapidly builds up. If you plot the voltage versus time as you turn the crank, and if you...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And if you monitor the current that the machine generates, you'll see a very peculiar characteristic. It starts off at a very low current. As it starts building up voltage, the current it generates increases. The rate at which the charge goes into the Leyden jars increases. It's not a sawtooth waveform with a linear slope to it. It looks like a parabolic curve. The thing has got a bootstrapping function that the higher the voltage, the faster it multiplies the voltage. And you're not getting something for nothing here. The drag that you feel as you turn the crank increases. You know you're doing a little bit more work as the voltage increases. And as those metal brushes are picking up the charges that exist on those metal spokes, these pieces of sheet metal that look like spokes, they're flat spokes of sheet metal that are on each one of these plastic discs, as the discs turn and the metal brushes pick up the charge on each one, you'll hear a static charge sizzling sound that increases in volume. You know you're operating with higher voltages, and the rate at which that sound increases, again, tells you that a bootstrapping operation is taking place. The rate at which it builds up charge increases with time. It's a very fancy machine. It's amazing that somebody way back in 1860 invented this thing. As I said, when you find this website called Multispark Gap Experiments, and you see the beautiful diagram they've got of this, this thing's got about 15 diagrams, and the diagram number 2 and 3 shows you something about how the machine works. You won't understand it at first. You'll have to study the diagram for quite a period of time. Here's the third diagram. Shows you test platform electrical schematic is the name of the damn thing, of that particular plate, showing you something about how the thing works. But it does a little bit of magic there, Paul. But for $79, with a carefully tuned machine, even before you carefully tune it, the thing will easily turn out 75 and maybe 100 kilovolts. You carefully tune it, and after a couple of years I found out how, I think I'm getting close to 200 kilovolts out of the thing.
Another comment, Dick?
And as I said, I can make it jump 3 inches and 5/8. Go ahead, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the deck mat.
And where's the arcing occurring? Between the plates?